It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Farm to Table Talk ends up on a table, and we're at a table today. We're talking to a chef, and not just any chef, but a chef that is renowned in a city that's known for having great food and other good chefs, a chef that's been recognized, a lady who is going to be heading a dinner in Sacramento that is really the crowning event of the Farm to Fork Festival in Sacramento. And I am really happy to welcome Suzette Gresham of Acarello Restaurant in San Francisco. Suzette, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you, Roger. I'm very pleased to be here.
Suzette, when you come from San Francisco to Sacramento, you know, you are a food capital in the whole world. I mean, San Francisco comes up when people say, name the great cities that have food and have a reputation for great restaurants and really outstanding chefs. And you're one of them. And in fact, you're one of them that has been awarded not one, but two Michelin stars. Not many get that honor. And it's even more rare for women. I think there are only a couple, three women in the whole United States that have earned two Michelin stars. So we were going to talk about that, talk about how you've gotten to this position, but also want to talk about how what brings you to Sacramento. Because Sacramento has, again, this event, and it's claimed to be Farm to Fork capital of America. And you're helping them celebrate that fact. So kind of give me a little background. What brought you to work on this event and help with this event in Sacramento?
Well, first of all, I have to say it's an honor to be here. It's a revelation to see what Sacramento is and has been doing. I was approached by Cynthia Ochterbeck from Michelin, actually, when they were getting ready to do a launch of the California Guide, which many people don't realize we're the only state to have our own Michelin Guide because we're warranted. But the thing that probably brought us to that point was that it was a recognition of a spirit, a joie de vivre, a mentality, a philosophy of the entire state. And Sacramento really embodies that here of the Farm to Fork. And certainly it might seem preposterous that they would be the only capital, but they're certainly one of the major capitals. They're one of the people who are willing to make the claim and stand behind it. That's the difference. I think that when you have a rural situation that's right in your backyard and you do something with it, it gives you the right to maybe make that claim. So when Cynthia approached me, they were making a video to show what one-star, two-star, and three-star restaurants looked like here in California. And I was so honored and pleased to have been selected to represent the two stars. And they spend a great deal of time and really wanted to know behind the scenes, in the people, of the food, of the origins, what does it take to produce something of that level. And I was greatly rewarded. And if you go and watch the videos, you'll see that they're wonderfully produced. And I was so happy and honored to be a part of that. And so when she mentioned that Visit Sacramento was helping to locate who was going to be their head, lead, or host, would I be interested? So I asked some tough questions. And if you are in the industry, you understand the value and also the weight of Michelin stars. And it took me very little time to realize that there's a very special community here in Sacramento. In fact, I've even asked the female chefs I've been working with, as well as the male counterparts, if they would adopt me, because it takes me back. It takes me back to what I remember back in the day, the sense of community amongst chefs. There's always competition. We understand that. But there should be a fraternity. There should always be that mentorship, that student, that middle ground, the learning, the desire to progress, the ability to move forward as a community as well as an individual. And I think in a larger, urban situation, you can often get lost. People come and go a little quicker. Sometimes you don't get to know them. People make names, whether you think it's validated or not. And you don't get that sense of wholeness that I seem to keep finding here. So when I came here, I realized that the Tower Bridge dinner is a big deal, flat out. And it would be an honor not only to follow Jeremiah Tower, who is one of the pillars of our industry for years, but to bring those forward who may just have been doing something quietly in the background and never quite been recognized the female chefs, the female winemakers, the female artisans, the cheese producers, the beer makers, all of the women in this industry who have quietly been working really diligently and really not being recognized. And if I can do that, plus celebrate Sacramento and really bring the farmers and the ranchers out, I will feel that something has been accomplished.
You know, we in fact met at a dinner that was Women in Agriculture, and it was outside of Sacramento. And
correct.
So in addition to all the people that are involved in the restaurants themselves, it did include women farmers. That
celebration was magnificent, I have to say, and that was another eye-opener as to the power of the consolidation of those skills and expertise. And it wasn't that anybody was really any better than anybody else, and if there was a weak point, they all gathered around, and it was so abundantly apparent they all wanted everyone to do well that you so seldom see that collaboration. It really just warmed my heart, and that's why I said to Bob and Mulvaney, was my table mate, that, oh my gosh, do you guys know what you have here? It's so special. And I actually posed that question to Michelin. I said, do you realize that the weight of Michelin can often divide a community? I don't want to be a part of that. If you're going to go in and help them to realize that this community is being recognized, not any one kitchen or any one chef, but this community has put their name on the map, that it's all of them here collectively doing what they are doing right now that's Michelin worthy. And that's what the message was that I wanted to share. And I said, if I can't do that for the Tower Bridge dinner, I don't want to be involved, because I don't want to divide this community. There's something that should be preserved here.
Well, it's so interesting, because even the fact that you have two Michelin stars, and then Michelin even contacted you about this, that you should talk to them, and that as this has come together, you've identified other women chefs that are in the Sacramento area that are part of your team. You're leading the team.
I have four fabulous leads, and I can name them for you.
Sure,
if you're interested in knowing. I'm very proud, Allison Harvey. And I believe she's with Ella's, and someone who's been in this industry and this vicinity for a while. I have Molly Hawks from Hawks, and she has at least two restaurants that I'm aware of. And I have Casey Schiedler, who is over at Taylor's Kitchen. And last but not least, I have Tokiko Sawada, who her and her husband are the owners of Binchoyaki. We went to dinner last night at Crew, of course, with Billy, and it was just heartwarming to hear the stories, the tales. They were chiding each other. They know each other, and there was none of the snippiness or snarkiness, or, I mean, they could call each other out. They knew dirt on each other, but it was lovingly playful. It was family. It completely took me off guard.
You know, earlier you mentioned that there's a fraternity, and I noted at the time that you didn't say sorority.
I think genderless. I call my guys in my kitchen ladies. I call my ladies guys. I'm genderless. I could care less. I would love to help bury that hatchet. I want to make sure that this dinner, although we're celebrating women who may not have been maybe as recognized, I've asked all my leads to have male sous chefs and have other people in the kitchen that represent this community. To me, it's genderless, and I really would love to share that message above all, because I think the day has come. The audience is willing to listen. It's time to move forward with the best chefs. Sex is not in the game.
It may not be in the game, but I would suspect that some of the sources of the food you're going to be providing are also going to be including some women farmers that are...
That is my goal.
So that's exciting. And you bring this up, and when you have an event like this and people can pay attention to what you're doing, and you're drawing attention to this wonderful event that does have women chefs, of women farmers involved, it begs a question in my mind, is has there been a glass ceiling? Is there... most of us grew up at a time when oftentimes we would have moms in the kitchen, and cooking you'd often would not necessarily be done as much by men, but when it came to chefs and especially famous restaurants, it was almost exclusively male for a while.
For generations, for eons, not just a while, forever.
Okay.
Forever.
So why?
Well, the fact that you as a man are asking that question is probably the most important advancement that we've made. Nobody really cared. Nobody was asking. Nobody wanted to know. Nobody believed that women could do the job that they're doing. I think there was stereotypes, if you will. There was ideas about what we could and couldn't do. And having myself been a cook this is my 40th year cooking, my 30th year of ownership at Acarello, I remember quite well what it was like in the kitchen, and all I could do was quietly prove them wrong. I could quietly withstand the heat, lift the pots, take on the rowdy attitudes, deal with all of the negativity, and just keep plodding through. I didn't realize, I mean, looking back now, I realize I was a pioneer, but I didn't realize it then. I just was so rather stupidly, like a mule, wanting something so bad that I felt no one had the right to take that from me, and I was going to get there come hell or high water. And every time I hit a roadblock, I just, whether I had a sidestep or go lateral, it was going to ultimately be that at the end of the day, I was going to be a chef. And I didn't believe it. You have to realize when you're going through this, you often don't believe. It's like an athlete. You don't know if you're going to hit your best time. You don't know if you're going to run the best race. You don't know if you'll be the fastest, the quickest. You just know what you want. And you want to get there, wherever there is. It's even almost undefined. I didn't know I could even be a chef, and I still went into it. I didn't know if I'd ever have, I didn't want to even be a restaurateur, be an owner. I thought I couldn't. I don't know if that makes any sense at all,
sure,
but
no.
You're fighting all odds and you know you're against everything, but it doesn't stop you. And you have to believe at some point something good will come. And it was only the men that helped me to achieve that. So I am definitely not anti or not supportive of my male counterparts. I have an all-male crew right now. And as I tell them, it's my biggest honor is to educate them into what a female chef can be. Lead by example. Look what we're doing. Look how we are. This is what you can consider. You don't need to necessarily do X, Y, Z to be a great chef. You need to do L, M, N, O, P. You know, and so it's options.
Now, it seems to me that a first criteria might be that you love food.
Oh, yes.
So you
it's
love
my
food.
Religion.
Okay, so you love food and you know what you love. Now, another criteria, it would seem to me, is to be creative. You know, it's like a sculptor. That you give him a big rock and it looks at this rock and envisions the art that can come out of it. That there's a bust of Lincoln or something in there. That you can look at food and be creative and say, I think I can create this.
Well, and the third element there is humility. If you are really humble enough to let the food be the food, that's the riskiest of all. Because we can all do something to something. But what is art? Art is when you can sometimes find the most pure, the most pristine, and leave it alone. That takes great restraint. And yet when you have a price point and you're doing fine dining, the expectation is very elevated. How do you make those two things line up? You and I could find the best burrata and slice the best tomatoes, but how do I take that to fine dining? So therein comes the rub. It's a conundrum. To find something that will accentuate but not overpower, that will elevate and yet not lose the essence of what you're doing.
That language is often used to describe terroir in wine, of let the wine bring the land and the flavor. And somebody was telling me that there's an area in Europe where they always have sheep grazing in the vineyards, and there's a certain something about the wines in that area that they believe is with the
unique.
Sheep involved.
It's unique.
Unique with the sheep.
Indeed.
So it's applying that same thing, not to overdo it then is what you're saying.
Correct. And imagine that creativity that you mentioned before isn't just with my food. It's with my management style. It's with my people. It's with my guests. I'm always looking at someone for that uniqueness that they bring. And as you know, as humans, we are imperfect. And so if I can bring out the best qualities in my people and the best qualities in my food, my diner has an opportunity that isn't always available everywhere else. There's a lot of heart on that plate. People say, oh, cook with love, and it sounds so trite. I really believe it. I think that when you build a better person, you build a better cook, you build a better chef, and in turn, you get much better food. So my model for my kitchen was pretty laughable 30 years ago. No one really believed in what I was doing, and I myself had my doubts. But I know now, after time and time again, when a chef of 20 years ago comes back to visit me and they talk about those key elements that they learned with me, or someone else goes off to another job and says, chef, oh my gosh, I didn't realize what I had when I was with you at Acarello. It is those defining moments that give you that little bit of oomph to believe in what you're doing. And it's taken this long for that to happen. And by and large, those were most of my male counterparts, because there wasn't a lot of women in the kitchen when I first started. So when that happens, you think, I'm on to something. Okay, this can't be all wrong. And the methodology changes and the mentality changes, and you're a believer at some point.
Well, you have a vision, and so if you're preparing something for. You're pulling everything together. You're pulling the kitchen together. You've got a picture, I imagine, in your mind, let alone an idea of what you're trying to accomplish with the flavor, of what the plate's going to look like when it leaves there.
Well, there's always a question when you're in the kitchen and you say, oh, it's missing something, right? We're designing a dish. It's missing something. But who can tell you what it's missing? There's the conversation. That's the tough question.
So do you have that conversation with a sous chef?
I have a fabulous gentleman. His name is Seth Turniansky. He's our CDC. And
what's that?
Chef de cuisine.
Oh, okay.
And he has evolved. It's been miraculous and wonderful to watch. He's always been talented, but his creativity has really gone up notches and notches. We just came back from a little whirlwind trip through Italy, and I can see the influence that it had on him, and I'm so grateful that he's a sponge for that, because many times people can be defensive about what they don't know, but if you're more open and more humble about what you don't know, you're willing to accept new information and new ideas and to try on things you've done before and revise them. And there's a huge amount of revision in our industry, because something can be good. You can hit it accidentally. You can hit it on purpose. But when it's not good, what do you do? I'm always the worst case scenario. I love to envision perfection, but I'm always dealing with less than that. How do I get there? What's going to take me there? What does this dish need? What does that person need? What does this upcoming week need? Where are we going? And I think from that perspective, your answers come in a different way than just saying, I want, I think, I need, which is very autocratic. I'm much more democratic in my respect to how I manage my kitchen.
Well, managing the kitchen, you've got to be right in the middle of it and making those decisions on the fly. I mean, it's not like some things that people say, well, I'm going to do this with my business. And so they talk about it, they think about it, they, you know, like a CDC went to Italy and get ideas and so forth. You're in the middle of it, and you get to make a decision or call on somebody or ask for something. That's quite a talent.
It's multifaceted, and you really have to be adept at identifying what the core issue is. Sometimes, you know, it's very easy to say, gentlemen, you know, is this what a 2-star Michelin plate looks like? But you can only say that once or twice before you dilute the quality of that comment. So that's my really in my back pocket if something's really, you know, the proverbial you know what is hitting the fan. But basically, I'll have to say, if you were the customer paying this amount of money, would you be happy with that item right there? Would you eat that? Do you think it's the best you could have done? Is it what you would wish your parents were eating right now? Would you like to bring your grandma and tell her this is what your education has brought you to this point? So I try to appeal to people so they see it through a different lens. It isn't like me saying, why did you do it that way? That might be the ultimate question or the first question, but it isn't the real answer. It's like if you come to work and you come in here and you care about what you're doing, you're going to yield a much different product than if you don't. So it's very important to me that you care about what you're doing. And if I see that you're not caring about your mise en place, your knives, your station, whatever, I'm going to use those examples to prove to you that you're not caring enough. And what is enough? Well, when I see that you've improved, I'll understand you're coming from a different place. I ask you what books you're reading. I ask you where you last ate. What are you looking on the internet? Do you follow these particular chefs? Are you watching how our industry is changing? And advocacy is yet another umbrella that's come to our industry that my youngsters in San Francisco simply need to pay rent to survive. And God forbid they even have health care or that they even have to consider anything of those costs before they get to what we almost consider peripherals. And yet those peripherals are the most important key contributors to their education. Where do you stand on waste? How do you feel about what's happening to our soil and our water sources? How do you feel about aquaculture and agriculture? How do you feel about all these topics? Because as I tell them pretty much once a week until they get sick of hearing it, that if they don't make some decisions and stand for something, someone else will decide for them. And what they have right now might be a thing of the past. So if you're willing to see everything that you work with now disappear, then say nothing.
Now, your restaurant is Italian.
Yep.
How often do you have to kind of like revisit the heritage of what you're preparing?
All the time. It's a philosophy. Because I'm not in Italy, and I'm not Italian. So I'm constantly challenged by that. When I first opened the restaurant, I was really bothered by it. Now I realize it's a gift. And you have to realize that many Italians now come to America because the freedom to create is here. Versus if you're in a region and in a restaurant in Italy, many times you're bound by the history, the tradition, the previous preparations, the thought of what those indigenous ingredients bring to the table, which even though they're all wonderfully great grounding sources, they're not the end-all be-all. But if there's not a mentality that can support your creativity, you can be considered just wrong. Your items just don't fly. Where in America, there's almost a little bit more leeway, if you will. And so if you say, these are gnocchi like my grandma used to make, that's one thing. But if you say, I had this vision about what gnocchi could be, so I made them like this, people go, yes, they like them, or no, they don't. But at least there's an opportunity to examine and try and taste and revisit what they could be. Like if you make them, molecular gastronomy is a famous little term in our industry, but if you can make a gnocchi that's equal to or better than the traditional classic way, I'll consider it. But if it's not equal to or better than, why are we manipulating these ingredients to a point where you can't recognize them anymore?
Well, one advantage you have, even though you're not in Italy, you're in a Mediterranean climate. You're right in the midst of...
It's beautiful here.
Everything that can be grown in Italy can be grown here. And
right.
So you find the olives and you find the fruits and the vegetables. And,
yeah, it's very simpatico. It's very similar.
So starting with that, the other thing that you have in Italy, when I've been to Italy, is you can find farmers markets and you can go get acquainted with farmers that are producing all these different things. How do you do that? How do you maintain relationships or know what's coming that's available to you?
I think it's a little easier there. If you notice even the structure of our cities, there's more rural areas right on the borders of their cities, sometimes more than ours. But Sacramento still has that.
Yes.
And that's why I'm excited about it here, because you don't have to drive very far in any one direction to hit agricultural belt here.
No.
And the relationships that a lot of the chefs that I've met here that they have with the farmers is a one-to-one. It's personal. They either went to school with them, they know them, they're on their farm, they're picking things, they help them out, the farmers come to their kitchen and drop off stuff. That's so romantic to me, because I'm in a city that I don't quite have that, but we really take advantage of our farmers markets. My CDC Seth on Saturday mornings arms himself with a cart and boxes and goes down and talks to whomever he likes to talk to and gets what he wants to get. And sometimes we have faxes ahead of time, or we have, you know, emails that come over. Oh, I've got a great amount of this, or this is running out. This is gapping. I don't have this anymore. And so he has really built a lot of those relationships and really, you know, get some dynamite ingredients for us. But you really have to be ready to change at the drop of a hat, because a small farmer often will run out of something quickly, or that something will change in the weather, or they just can't bring you something that's the right size for whatever your dish may be. And fine dining is a very odd critter in that it's so specific. If you're making a little more rustic food, you can get away with certain things a little easier, I feel. And fine dining is very fickle. It's very fickle. So it makes it a little more difficult.
Well, it might make it more difficult, but it must be very gratifying when you just hit it and you know
very much so.
It's all there. It's you've got the right ingredients. It's come together perfectly, and then you get the feedback from your customers. I looked a little bit online, and my goodness, I couldn't believe all the people that just say that it's, you know, their favorite restaurant ever, and people that come to San Francisco and they always come to see you. And if you've been in this business long enough, you must have some acquaintances that you've built up over the years.
But there I have to give a tip of the hat to my partner, Giancarlo Paterlini, and I have been together. This is our 30th year in July. He's a master at the dining room. He's just a 6'2" ballerina, if you will. He glides. He never intrudes. He knows his wines. He knows his service. He knows his people. He reads people's faces. He reads any situation and is really intuitive and very prompt to deal with whatever he thinks that it is that they want or what they're looking for. You very seldom find a front-of-the-house guy that's so in tune to that. My waiters are incredible. They've been with us for a long time. They're people pleasers. They really want to make you happy. It isn't about the tip. It isn't about the money. They don't feel good if you don't have a good time. That's that caring idea, that notion that we represent something. Our SOM team is spectacular. If you say you want to spend $200 or $20, they're going to find something. They're going to find something for you. Buy the glass, buy the bottle. You want to have an experience. You've been to Italy. You've never been to Italy. What is it you would like to do? And they have over 100 pages, and they'll see them back in the corner flipping through our wine guide saying, oh, here it is. This is what this person would like. And it's not just cookie cutter. It's not just, oh, this is what we're moving this week. We're going to sell this to everybody. Contrarily, I give my wine director endless measures of grief, because we have an over exuberant wine list and collection that allows us to do that. And it is a compendium. It's a mixture of that front of the house, the service, the food, the ambiance. I don't think I could do what I do without any of those other pieces. That's what makes the experience. It's not just eating. That's an experience. We really wanted, Giancarlo and I, when we opened the restaurant, for whatever you're paying for dinner to be equal to your ticket to Italy. We wanted it to be that experience. We didn't want you to walk away thinking, oh, that was good pasta, and that's all you think about. Maybe that was the best pasta you had, but oh my gosh, do you remember this? Do you remember that? I mean, we do stuzzucchini, which is a little bite to start the meal. We do aperitivos. We do mignardis at the end of the meal. We have our house-made biscotti. So there's all these little hidden things tucked away that, to me, are that Italian graciousness, that sense of warmth and hospitality. And I think that builds an experience. That's most important.
And you must be hitting it, because not only are people coming back, and you've been in a it's a difficult business for many people, and you've been successful in San Francisco, and there's a lot of competition in San Francisco, and you've been recognized by Michelin. Can you explain the Michelin system to people a little bit? I mean, how do people come to earn the first Michelin star?
Well, it's a guide, and you know, being a guide is not an easy position to be in. That means you're picking and making selections and recommendations. So starting out in France, when they were, you know, more recognized as a tire company, they simply made little touring guides that were more of maps. Some of the best maps you can get are still made by Michelin in Europe. And then they began to recognize little places to stay. And then it was places to eat. And then it became a full-bore dining guide. But that was an evolution for many years. And so the process coming to America didn't happen until the early 2000s. I think they went to New York first, and Chicago and San Francisco. We were the first. Our first star was in 2007, so that's when they first came to San Francisco. And they've been in Los Angeles, they've pulled out of Los Angeles, they've gone back to Los Angeles. So they govern that themselves, it's hard to say. And I think it's always a conundrum for chefs to understand, what am I going to have to do to get a star? But that's not what I recommend. What I recommend is be true to yourself, be true to your cuisine, follow your passion, and always do the best you have wanted to do and the best you can do if you want to be recognized. It's just the creme de la creme, it's on the top of that. But that isn't why we do what we do. If you ask a chef, why do you do what you do, the answers you get are much more the keys to their success than they even realize. It's just taking it to another level. It's always pushing that envelope. How could I do better? What could I do better? Who could I do better with? What product should I have? Is my wine list where it should be? Do I do good service? I mean, it's that constant self-analysis, I think, that really allows you to grow. And if you're afraid to do the self-analysis, you get stuck. So you really have to be the first one to be brutally honest with yourself. And, you know, the world doesn't have to be fine dining, but the world is made up of many moving parts and pieces. And especially, I really relate that to the community here in Sacramento, because there's so much good food here. How do you stand out? That becomes difficult. Do you have the clientele base to support that? What if a restaurant really wants to be upper end? Is that what will sell here? Is that what would sell in San Diego? Will it sell, you know, in Bakersfield? I mean, pick another area, and it gets hard. It's very hard to pull it off. So getting a star is one thing. Next is the next level. And I would ask, because, you know, they call you every year when they are announcing that you're going to be a recipient. And I would ask the inspectors when they would call, like, what do I do to get better? Is there something I should consider? You know, and I never really got a concrete answer, and I realized the answer lies with me, and that I really had to find a way to elevate what I already thought I was doing, and to find a way to just increase that and bring it up a notch. And how do you define what that notch is? It's very personal. It's very hard. I don't know what it takes to get a third star, and I don't want to fly in the face of the culinary gods at all, but I don't know that I ever would look at it that way. I don't look at things that way. I want to just get better for our sake, for my team's sake, so they'll be proud of us, for the front of the house, for all of us, for the Acarello name. I don't think I would have ever thought of, like, oh, I have to get a star. I know people who feel that way, but that wasn't my motivation. That sounds terrible to say, but I'm not motivated by that. The recognition was so far off my radar. I have flown under the radar for years that it never was the motivator, that getting recognition wasn't the motivator. It's wonderful to have it, but I didn't pursue it.
You know, it's interesting, too, that you were saying that after you get notified that you have a star, that you could actually talk to them, and they call you and say, you know, you got a star, you got two stars, And you could say, okay, well, how did I earn? How did I go from one to two? Or how could I earn a star in the first place? And it's interesting to me that you can get that feedback from them.
Don't think I got the feedback I wanted.
Oh, you
wanted
more.
I wanted more nuts and bolts. I wanted to know A through Z, what do I need to do? And I don't know that I ever got that.
You know, it's so hard to describe. I mean, I've gone to restaurants that just hit it out of the park. And it's hard for an amateur like me to go out and articulate what it was about it. But the whole experience, you just thought.
But the question is, how many times do they hit it out of the park? Is that consistent? Was that a good day? You know, you never know. You can't be a fly on the wall and understand what is it they do consistently or inconsistently.
Well, and if you look enough online, you see everybody has an off night, too.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And, you know, someone didn't show up for work or some other problem.
It's just like theater, honestly, Roger. The curtain goes up and there's no excuse. The curtain goes up, you're open, no excuse.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Well, again, you get back to the pressure. I mean, you talk about the fact that there's a front of the house and the back of the house, or there's the kitchen. You know, the front of the house is to make everybody feel warm and welcome and attentive, and they're glad they're there. But you're in the midst in the back. It's got to be somewhat chaotic sometime. I mean, there's a lot of pressure.
I love chaos.
Oh, so you're in the middle of. So that's one of the prerequisites to be a good chef, probably.
I think chefs and emergency room doctors are probably the same job with different tools.
That's a really, really good way of putting it. Now let's come back again to Sacramento. So you are in this process of putting together the Bridge Dinner, which is the culmination of the Farm to Fork Festival. And they've got, like, I think they had 100,000 people come to the Farm to Fork Festival. I don't know anywhere in the country that pulled that kind of a crowd together.
Well, and to stop the travel on the bridge and put dining rooms up on a bridge, come on, that's pretty crazy.
It is pretty crazy. I was there last year, and it was unbelievable, a great experience. And they totally sell out, and it's not an inexpensive ticket, but they have to have a raffle for one or two seats that are available that people try to jump in and get into it. But it's just a phenomenal event. So leading up to it now, you have started with the chefs that are part of your team to put together the menu?
It's done. We're done.
You're done with the menu.
We're rolling. I've been really impressed with everyone I've worked with. Many of the smart things that have been in, such as the keeping and the listing of things that did and didn't work, the advisory council that's joined us because they experienced this bridge dinner before and have wisdom. There's lots of things in place. So I get to look good, but they've done a huge amount of work here locally. They've been very smart about how they've approached this, between running a field kitchen, having a commissary kitchen, getting the items grown for them from
the
farmer.
That's a commissary kitchen.
Well, I may say this wrong for the sake here, but honestly, we go to Golden One. That's where our hub is.
And it's where they play basketball here. It's a downtown.
The kitchens there are phenomenal. So we're going to play a different game back there. But it's all over the place. There's lots of space. And so all of these chefs will come in with their ingredients and will be lining up their teams, their crews, doing their food. We make a master game plan as to what's done on day three out, day two out, day one out, day of. And then we have a field kitchen set up in a parking lot off the side of the bridge that will have all refrigeration trucks. It'll have our stoves and heating elements. It'll have our carriers. And we'll transport our food over there so everything's held sanitary and safe. And then it gets fed out to six stations on the bridge. And then those stations serve about 130, 140 people per station.
So it's like 850.
It's 850 we're planning for.
850.
And if you count some dietary restrictions, 900.
Yeah. And then the team that's working, are they coming from each restaurant, the staff, the servers and all?
The team is assembled for service through a bevy of volunteers. And all of the culinarians, it's such an honor here. Sacramento has really enjoyed this event. So a lot of the culinarians offer themselves up that want to be a part of one of the stations or the teams or be under one of these chefs. These chefs are well-loved and respected in their own kitchens, let alone their community. So people really want to work with and for them. And then it, you know, comes up to the lead chefs, and then it comes up to me. And I just think that I have the best job of all because I simply offer up and suggest, and sometimes they look at me a little cross-eyed and say, "Chef, I don't think we can do that, but we're going to try." But they're so receptive. And there's such a respect here for our craft and for our industry and for the farmers and ranchers, too. And that's always the best, and you don't always have that. I mean, I've worked in lots of other communities. That's not always the case.
So let's bring the farmers and ranchers in right now. So you know what's going to be on the plate. So some of this that's going to be consumed in September is maybe not even in the ground yet. There are things that are being...
It is up this morning.
Literally planting the seeds for some of the products that you're going to have.
Indeed, it's actually happening. As an outsider, I'm like, are you sure? Is this going to work? Can we really count on this? Do we need a backup plan? Because it's Mother Nature. And, you know, she does what she wants. You're not telling her what to do. And yet there's this great confidence that the chefs have here who've dealt with these, you know, farmers and ranchers. They know what they're going to get. They know the work ethic. They know the philosophy. Same thing I'm talking about in my kitchen and my food. So there is a belief system in place that they can produce, which will allow the chef to produce as well. And I'm just marveled when I hear and see. I've been out to Twin Peaks Orchard with Camelia, who's the family that owns and runs it, where the Women in Ag Dinner was held. And I went away and canned some of their apricots and dealt with some of their peaches and nectarines and went back and visited Produce Express. And I just can't believe how everything is so interconnected and working so well.
Well, cross your fingers. It sounds good. And I think Mother Nature is on our side because we're producing all of this food. Unless Mother Nature holds a grudge on the fact that they changed the name from City of Trees to the Farm to Fork Capital, because that was the other name that we have for Sacramento.
I think she'd still be pleased.
I think Mother Nature is going to be happy
with
this.
Happy.
And so will anybody that comes to this event. So it's a wonderful event. And I wonder, in addition to enjoying and participating in this event, I wonder what opportunities there are in other communities to follow some of that lead and try to connect and celebrate Farm to Fork.
You know, sometimes it's baby steps, and my daughters are, you know, sick of hearing the term baby steps. My cooks are hearing the term baby steps, but it really is. It starts with each one of us, and if I could empower anyone to just simply think different, look different, give something a second chance, go to a farmer's market, buy a vegetable you've never had before, talk to a farmer you've never met before, buy something from a rancher, support your local products, whether it's your coffee here, whether it's your honey here, the eggs, whatever the case is, because money that flows to those people keeps them solvent and keeps them involved and keeps them around. And I really want to be able to support that system. I don't want it to go away. I don't want someone else to dictate to us what we're going to have to eat and where it's going to come from. I really want that control to be us. And then if that transfers up to a chef, if you have an educated consumer, you are raising the bar for yourself to have to do a little bit more, because now if they're cooking that way at home, you have to do something equal to or better than. And so it helps to elevate the whole process and keeps everyone, you know, moving and thinking in that direction. Sometimes we only see the barriers. We only see the walls. Other communities say, well, there's no structure. There's no support. Well, start it. Ask. Go figure it out. Go meet the farmer. See if he'll drop off at your door. Go out on Wednesdays and pick up your stuff. I mean, start somewhere. It's never perfect. It's never going to be perfect. So you have to start with the baby steps and deal with the imperfections.
Well, it seems to me that the steps are getting much bigger than baby now, because you've done so much in getting this lined up. It's going to be another outstanding event in Sacramento, the Farm to Fork Festival, the Bridge Dinner. Suzette Gresham, I really appreciate your being here. Spell your restaurant's name for people that would like to get on the list to be able to come to your restaurant.
If you want to look it up, just think of the color aqua, but it's spelled different. It's A-C-Q-U-E-R-E-L-L-O. Acquarello in Italian means watercolor. And so if you want to remember it, just remember the ACQ, and then you can find us from there.
This event, for people that want to see all of this unfolding, it's going to be the Farm to Fork Festival that's going to be taking place in Sacramento. They can look at Bridge Dinner. They can look at Visit Sacramento sites to see what's happening and then watch after it gets underway. I really appreciate what you're doing, and I want to thank you for being on Farm to Table
Talk.
I'd
like to thank you and thank the community here for this opportunity.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.